English 9, Myths and Make-Believe.
The Field of Boliauns, a folktale. One fine day in harvest, it was indeed Lady Day in harvest, that everybody knows to be one of the greatest holidays in the year, Tom Fitzpatrick was taking a ramble through the ground, and went along the sunny side of a hedge, when all of a sudden he heard a clacking sort of noise a little before him in the hedge. "Dear me," said Tom, "but isn't it surprising to hear the stone chatters singing so late in the season?" So Tom stole on, going on the tops of his toes, to try if he could get a sight of what was making the noise, to see if he was right in his guess. The noise stopped, but as Tom looked sharply through the bushes, what should he see in a nook of the hedge but a brown pitcher that might hold about a gallon and a half of liquor, and by and by a little wee teeny-tiny bit of an old man with a little motty of a cocked hat stuck upon the top of his head, a deeshy-doshy leather apron hanging before him, pulled out a little wooden stool and stood upon it and dipped a little piggin into the pitcher and took out the full of it and put it beside the stool and then sat down under the pitcher and began to work at putting a heel piece on a bit of a brogue just fit for himself. "Well, by the powers," said Tom to himself, "I often hear tell of the leprechauns, and to tell God's truth I never rightly believed in them. But here's one of them in real earnest. If I go knowingly to work, I'm a made man. They say a body must never take their eyes off them, or they'll escape." Tom now stole on a little further, with his eye fixed on the little man, just as a cat does with a mouse. So when he got up quite close to him, "God bless your work, neighbour," said Tom. The little man raised up his head. "And thank you kindly," says he. "I wonder you'd be working on the holiday," said Tom. "That's my own business, not yours," was the reply. "Well, maybe you'd be civil enough to tell me what you've got in the picture there," said Tom. "That I will, with pleasure," said he. "It's good beer." "Beer," said Tom. "Thunder and fire, where did you get it?" "Where did I get it, is it? Why, I made it. And what do you think I made it of?" "Divil a one of me knows," says Tom. "But of malt, I suppose. What else?" "Then you're out. I made it of heath." "Of heath?" said Tom, bursting out laughing. "Sure you don't think me to be such a fool as to believe that." "Do as you please," said he. "But what I tell you is the truth. Did you never hear of the Danes?" "Well, what about them?" said Tom. "Why, all the about them there is that when they were here, they taught us to make beer out of the heath, and the secret's in my family ever since." "Will you give a body a taste of your beer?" said Tom. "I'll tell you what it is, young man. It will be fitter for you to be looking after your father's property than to be bothering decent, quiet people with your foolish questions. There now, while you're idling away your time here, there's the cows have broken into the oats and are knocking the corn all about." Tom was taken so by surprise with this that he was just on the very point of turning round when he recollected himself. So, afraid that the like might happen again, he made a grab at the leprechaun and caught him up in his hand, but in his hurry overset the pitcher and spilled all the beer, so that he could not get a taste of it to tell what sort it was. He then swore that he would kill him if he did not show him where his money was. Tom looked so wicked and so bloody-minded that the little man was quite frightened. So, says he, "Come along with me a couple of fields off, and I will show you a crock of gold." So they went, and Tom held the leprechaun fast in his hand and never took his eyes off him, though they had to cross hedges and ditches and a crooked bit of bog, till at last they came to a great field all full of boliauns. And the leprechaun pointed to a big boliaun and says he, "Dig under that boliaun and you'll get the great crock all full of guineas." Tom, in his hurry, had never thought of bringing a spade with him, so he made up his mind to run home and fetch one, and that he might know the place again, he took off one of his red garters and tied it round the boliaun. Then he said to the leprechaun, "Swear you'll not take that garter away from that boliaun." And the leprechaun swore right away not to touch it. "I suppose," said the leprechaun very civilly, "you'll have no further occasion for me." "No," says Tom, "you may go away now if you please, and God speed you, and may good luck attend you wherever you go." Well, goodbye to you, Tom Fitzpatrick, said the leprechaun, and much good may it do you when you get it. So Tom ran for dear life, till he came home and got a spade, and then away with him as hard as he could go, back to the field of bullions. But when he got there, lo and behold, not a bullion in the field but had a red garter, the very model of his own, tied about it. And as to digging up the whole field, that was all nonsense, for there were more than 40 good Irish acres on it. So Tom came home again with his spade on his shoulder, a little cooler than he went, and many's the hearty curse he gave the leprechaun every time he thought of the neat turn he had served him. How platypuses came to Australia. A folk story. A young duck used to swim away by herself in the creek. Her tribe told her that Moloka, the water devil, would catch her some day if she was so venturesome, but she did not heed them. One day, after having swum down some distance, she landed on a bank where she saw some young green grass. She was feeding about when suddenly Begoon, an immense water rat, rushed out from a hidden place and seized her. She struggled and struggled, but all in vain. "I live alone," he said. "I want a wife." "Let me go," said the duck. "I am not for you. My tribe has a mate for me."
"You stay quietly with me and I will not hurt you. I am lonely here. If you struggle more or try to escape, I will knock you on the head or spear you with this little spear I always carry."
"But my tribe will come and fight you and perhaps kill me."
"Not they. They will think Moloka has got you. But even if they do come, let them. I am ready."
And again he showed his spear. The duck stayed. She was frightened to go while the rat watched her. She pretended that she liked her new life and meant to stay always, while all the time she was thinking how she would escape. She knew her tribe came to look for her, for she heard them. But Begoon kept her imprisoned in his hole in the side of the creek all day, only letting her out for a swim at night, when he knew her tribe would not come out for fear of Moloka. She hid her feelings so well that at last Begoon thought she really was content with him, and gradually he gave up watching her, taking his long day sleep as of old. Then came her chance. One day, when Begoon was sound asleep, she slunk out of the burrow, slid into the creek, and swam away up it as quickly as she could towards her old camp. Suddenly she heard a sound behind her. She thought it must be Begoon, or perhaps the dreaded Moloka, so, stiff as her wings were, she raised herself on them and flew the rest of the way, alighting at length, very tired, among her tribe. They all gabbled around her at once, hardly giving her time to answer them. When they heard where she had been, the old mother ducks warned all the younger ones to swim only upstream in the future, for Begoon would surely have vowed vengeance against them all now, and they must not risk meeting him. How that little duck enjoyed her liberty, and being with her tribe again! How she splashed as she pleased in the creek in the daytime, and flew about at night if she wished! She felt as if she never wanted to sleep again. It was not long before the laying season came. The ducks all chose their nesting places, some in hollow trees and some in myria bushes. When the nests were all nicely lined with down feathers, the ducks laid their eggs. Then they sat patiently on them until at last the little fluffy, downy ducks came out. Then in a little time the ducks in the trees took the ducklings on their backs and in their bills and flew into the water with them one at a time. Those in the myria bushes waddled out with their young ones after them. In due course, the duck who had been imprisoned by Begoon hatched out her young, too. Her friends came swimming around the myria bush she was in and said, "Come along, bring out your young ones, too. Teach them to love the water as we do." Out she came, only two children after her. And what were they? Such a quacking gabble her friends set up, shrieking, "What are those?" "My children," she said proudly. She wouldn't show that she too was puzzled at her children's being quite different from those of her tribe. Instead of down feathers, they had a soft fur. Instead of 2 feet, They had four. Their bills were those of ducks, and their feet were webbed, and on the hind ones were just showing the points of a spear, like Bigoon always carried to be in readiness for his enemies. "Take them away!" cried the ducks, flapping their wings and making a great splash. "Take them away! They're more like Bigoon than us. Look at their hind feet. The tip of his spear is sticking from them already. Take them away, or we shall kill them before they grow big and kill us. They don't belong to our tribe. Take them away! They have no right here!" And such a row they made that the poor little mother duck went off with her two little despised children, of whom she had been so proud, despite their peculiarities. She didn't know where to go. If she went down the creek, Bigoon might catch her again and make her live in the burrow, or kill her children because they had webbed feet, a duck's bill, and had been hatched out of eggs. He would say they didn't belong to his tribe. No one would own them. There would never be anyone but herself to care for them. The sooner she took them right away, the better. So thinking, away upstream she went until she reached the mountains. There she could hide from all who knew her and bring up her children. On and on she went until the creek grew narrow and scrubby on its banks, so changed from the broad streams which used to flow placidly between large unbroken plains that she scarcely knew it. She lived there for a little while, then pined away and died, because even her children, as they grew, saw how different they were from her and kept away by themselves, until she felt too lonely and miserable to live, too unhappy to find food. Thus pining, she soon died away on the mountains, far from her old Noorumba or hereditary hunting ground, which was hers by right of birth. The children lived on and throve, laid eggs and hatched out more children just like themselves, until at last, pair by pair, they so increased that before long all the mountain creeks had some of them. And there they still live, the Gayadari, or platypus, quite a tribe apart. For when did ever a rat lay eggs, or a duck have 4 feet? Anansi and his visitor, Turtle. A folk story. It was almost time for Sun to sink to his resting place when Turtle, tired and dusty from hours of wandering, came to Anansi's house in the middle of a clearing in the woods. Turtle was hungry, and the appetizing aroma of freshly cooked fish and yams drew him to approach Anansi's door and to knock. Anansi jerked the door open. When he saw the tired stranger, he was inwardly annoyed. But it was an unwritten law of his country that one must never, no, never, refuse hospitality to a passer-by. Anansi smiled grimly and said, come in, and share my dinner, Mr. Turtle. As Turtle stretched out one paw to help himself from the steaming platter, Anansi almost choked on a mouthful of food. In a shocked voice he said, Turtle, I must remind you that in my country it is ill-mannered to come to the table without first washing. Please go to the stream at the foot of the hill and wash your dusty paws. Turtle waddled down the hill and waded in the water for a while. He even washed his face. By the time he had trudged back up the trail to Anansi's house, the platter of fish was half empty. Anansi was eating at a furious rate. Turtle stretched out one paw to help himself to food, but again Anansi stopped him. Turtle, your paws are still dusty. Please go wash them.
It's the dust from the long trail up the hill, Turtle explained in a meek voice.
Clearly it was not Turtle's place to argue if he expected to share the delectable meal, so he crawled down the hill a second time and rewashed his paws. Turtle was careful to walk on the grass beside the dusty trail on the climb back to Anansi's house. He hurried, for by now he was ravenous. But, oh dear, Anansi had scraped a platter bare of fish and yams.
My, that was a good dinner, he said, wiping the last drop of gravy from his chin.
Thank you for your wonderful hospitality, Anansi. Some day you must visit me.
And Turtle, in a huff, went on home. Some months later, Anansi visited Turtle.
After creepy crawling all day from one tall grass stem to the next, he found Turtle snoozing beside the river.
"Well, well," exclaimed Turtle, "so you've come to share my dinner. Make yourself comfortable, my dear Anansi, while I go below and prepare the food."
He plunged into the river with a splash. Anansi was hungry. He paced the shore and watched for Turtle's reappearance. At last, Turtle's head popped above the water.
"Dinner is ready," he called as he bit into a huge clam. "Come on down."
Then he disappeared from sight. Anansi dived headfirst into the water, sank a few inches, then floated to the surface. His spindly legs and tiny body prevented him from sinking. He flipped and flapped his puny arms, tried swallow dives and belly flops, but he could not reach the bed of the river. Then that cunning spider schemed. He filled the pockets of his jacket with small, round pebbles, dived into the river, and sank with a bump that landed him right at the dinner table. Before him was spread the most delicious meal he had ever seen. There were oysters and clams, mussels, slices of eel, and crabs. As a centerpiece, sprays of watercress rested against large pink shrimp. Anansi's eyes widened with pleasure. His stomach rumbled in anticipation. Turtle, already seated at the table, swallowed a piece of eel, looked at Anansi and said,
"Oh, Anansi, I must remind you that in my country it is ill-mannered to come to the table wearing a jacket. Please take it off."
Very slowly, Anansi removed his jacket. Very slowly, Anansi left the table. Without the weight of the pebbles to hold him down, he floated straight up through the green water and out of sight. When you set out to outsmart another person to your own advantage, there is usually someone who can outsmart you.
How Albizaron Fooled the Devil, a Folk Tale. There was once a man called Albizaron who wandered about looking for work, a restless fellow. He wandered here, he wandered there, but more often there than here. One day he was told that in the house of the devil there was need for a servant. "Pues ten cuidado," they warned, a forceful way of saying, "Watch out." Two servants the devil had already slain. He was a mean one. All who worked for him ended up dead, much sooner than later, too. Clearly a recommendation to avoid that house. But Albizaron retorted, "I'm on my way. The devil won't frighten me." So, to the devil's front door he went and knocked. Who should open the door but the devil himself? "Have you work for a strong man?" "Work enough for 6 strong men. You are sure there are not 5 more of you? Ah, well, pase adentro." In walked Albizaron. The devil led him to the room where he was to sleep. "Rest," he said. "Tomorrow you will begin your chores." Albizaron stretched himself on the bed. Before long, healthy snores were livening up that corner of the house. The next day, the devil sent him to fetch water. But Albizaron demanded, "Give me a pick and shovel." The devil, without any fuss, gave them. Albizaron went down to the river. He began digging a ditch from the stream to the devil's house. Like 6 men, he toiled. Well, like 3, anyway. At 11 o'clock came the devil to check up on Albizaron. "Water, I wish, not a ditch. Explain yourself," he commanded. "I am digging a canal to your house. Then there will be no need to go for water. Water will flow to you." The devil reflected. This man can dig. The trench is already the depth of a pitchfork. The devil knew his pitchforks. Moreover, this man can think. He didn't like that at all. It was such a distasteful thought that he went off home. A few days later, the devil ordered Albizaron to fetch a load of wood. Albizaron demanded, "Give me a length of rope, a long length." Without much ado, the devil gave it. Albizaron took the rope on his shoulder and went off to the mountain. There he set himself to wind the rope around the trees, around the whole forest. The rope was a lengthy length, all right. With all his tramping, the heels of El Bizarron's shoes were worn to a fraction of a millimeter. Not enough sole remained to measure a fraction of anything. At 11 o'clock, when the devil came to see what El Bizarron was up to, he found him with the rope looped around the mountain, as a collar wreathes the neck. Of course he wanted to know. "What are you doing?" El Bizarron answered, "Securing the mountain of wood so I can carry it back in one trip." "What a barbarian," thought the devil, and he directed El Bizarron to return to the house. Without the mountain, no room for that in the backyard. Soon after, there was a throwing contest on the beach with metal bars. The devil thought, "I shall send this strong fellow as a competitor. With his muscles, he must surely win me a prize." And he led El Bizarron to the shore, El Bizarron with a bar balanced on his shoulder. At the beach, everyone was practicing and preparing himself for the match, except El Bizarron. That one curled himself on the sunny sand and took a snooze. The day peeled off its hours. The contest began. Came the turn of El Bizarron. Loudly he cried out, "Order those faraway boats to sail away, otherwise I will sink them with my shot." As this was impossible, they would not permit him to throw. It was a disappointment to all, in particular to the devil, who felt more and more uneasy about El Bizarron's strength and his acuteness. "Too dangerous is this ox with this fox's brain," he decided. "I must rid myself of him." The two made their way back to the devil's house. In a buttery manner, the devil suggested that since he desired to spend that night stretched out on the iron grill of the barbecue, El Bizarron might wish to sleep beneath. "Why not?" asked El Bizarron in an offhand way. So it was arranged. The devil then hid two heavy, heavy rocks that he planned to drop on El Bizarron during the night. Evening fell, and both lay down in their places, the devil on the high grill and El Bizarron underneath. But El Bizarron noticed that the devil appeared to be much bulkier than usual. A suspicious sign. Unknown to the devil, El Bizarron changed his bed to a corner, a far corner, and waited. At midnight he heard the clangor of falling rocks. At once he shouted, "Aye, what a mosquito has bitten me!" Naturally, the devil thought, two boulders have dropped on him, and to this fellow they are no more than an insect bite. He was impressed, disturbed, shaken to his red marrow. He climbed down to note exactly El Bizarron's condition. This one was now sitting under the barbecue, unbruised, unscratched, unmarked. And there lay the smashed rocks. "Ah," said El Bizarron in a voice of wonder, "I believed it was a mosquito, and instead it was these stones. How came they here?" Now the devil's teeth clacked with fright. Speaking between clacks, he declared, "Fellow, I shall give you a burrow loaded with silver if you will leave here, if you leave for a destination far, far away, preferably the moon, or farther." El Bizarron accepted the offer. Why not? He brought up the burrow. The devil filled the saddlebags with money till they bulged like sacks of potatoes. "There you have it. Now go." El Bizarron went. After he had been gone a while, the devil's wife said to him, "That ninny deceived you. He is not as strong as all that." She flung sneers against the devil, as if she were hurling stones at a stray dog. Her scorn convinced her husband. So saddling a horse, he set out to find El Bizarron and take from him the donkey and the riches. Looking back, El Bizarron glimpsed the devil approaching at a distance. Quickly, he hid the donkey in a field of sugar cane. Then he lay on his back in the middle of the road with his legs in the air. The devil came up. In astonishment, he asked, "And what ails you?" "Ah, nothing. That stubbornness of a donkey refused to walk, so I gave him a kick that sent him above the clouds." The devil, his teeth clattering again, wanted to know, "But why are you lying there kicking at the wind?" "I don't want the donkey killed when he drops back to earth. This way I'll ease his fall with my feet." At that, the palsy of the devil's teeth affected the rest of him. He might have been a flag lashed by a gale. Swiftly, he spurred his horse and galloped home. His wife asked, "Did you catch him?" "Catch him? Should I want to?" There he was, no sign of the burrow. He had kicked it to heaven. And if I had waited to recover the money, he might have booted me to heaven. And what place is that for the devil? Glad am I to be free of him.
English 9, The Outsiders.
Jamie by Elizabeth Brewster. When Jamie was 16, suddenly he was deaf. There were no songs, no voices anymore. He walked about, stunned by the terrible silence. Kicking a stick, rapping his knuckles on doors, he felt a spell of silence all about him, so loud it made a whirring in his ears. People moved mouths without a sound escaping. He shuddered at the straining of their throats, and suddenly he watched them with suspicion, wondering if they were talking of his faults, were pitying him or seeing him with scorn. He dived into their eyes and dragged up sneers, and sauntering the streets, imagined laughter behind him, working at odd jobs, ploughing, picking potatoes, chopping trees in the lumber woods in winter. He became accustomed to an aimless and lonely labour. He was solitary and unloquacious as a stone, and silence grew over him like moss on an old stump. But sometimes, going to town, he was sore with the hunger for company among the people, and getting drunk would shout at them for friendship, laughing aloud in the streets. He returned to the woods, and dreaming at night of a shining cowboy heaven, where guns crashed through his deafness, awoke morose and chopped the necks of pine trees in his anger. Quinnipoxet by Stanley Kunitz. I was fishing in the abandoned reservoir back in Quinnipoxet, where the snapping turtles cruised and the bullheads swayed in their bower of tree stumps, sleek as eels and pigeon fat. One of them gashed my thumb with a flick of his razor fin when I yanked the barb out of his gullet. The sun hung its terrible coals over Buto's farm. I saw the treetops seething. They came suddenly into view on the Indian road, evenly stepping past the apple orchard, commingling with the dust they raised, their cloud of being, against the dripping light, looming larger and bolder. She was wearing a mourning bonnet and a wrap of shining taffeta. "Why don't you write?" she cried from the folds of her veil. "We never hear from you." I had nothing to say to her, but for him who walked behind her in his dark, worsted suit, with his face averted as if to hide a scald deep in his other life, I touched my forehead with my swollen thumb, in deaf-mute country, the sign for father.
Warning by Jenny Joseph. When I am an old woman, I shall wear purple, with a red hat which doesn't go and doesn't suit me. And I shall spend my pension on brandy and summer gloves and satin sandals, and say, "We've no money for butter." I shall sit down on the pavement when I'm tired, and gobble up samples in shops, and press alarm bells, and run my stick along the public railings, and make up for the sobriety of my youth. I shall go out in my slippers in the rain, and pick the flowers in other people's gardens, and learn to spit. old woman seated by Francis Gill. I am not to go into the attic because I am known to fall. But when they are out and the house cracks its joints, I am often there, wearing clothes which have been sent to a jumble sale for Christian Aid, taking tea in a chair they do not like. Sometimes I air decided views on the young, or read Mrs. Henry Wood, or put some flowers in a clear vase with the stem showing, which is not permitted. When they return to find me a little tired from not unraveling a sweater for Oxfam or writing to a grandchild who will not reply, they discuss me in voices that have had the benefits of speech training, and although dissatisfied, they can't prove anything.
A Helping Hand by Miroslav Holub. We gave a helping hand to grass, and it turned into corn. We gave a helping hand to fire, and it turned into a rocket. Hesitatingly, cautiously, we give a helping hand to people, to some people. Summer Camp by F.R. Scott. Here is a lovely little camp built among the Laurentian hills by a children's welfare society, which is entirely supported by voluntary contributions. All summer long, underprivileged children scamper about, and it is astonishing how soon they look happy and well. 2 weeks here in the sun and air, through the charity of our wealthy citizens, will be a wonderful help to the little tots when they return for a winter in the slums.
English 9, Living with Nature.
There Are Some Things by Joe Carson. There are some things I want to know about. I want to know what happened to the trees. There used to be big trees, big enough you could hollow you a room inside and live inside a living tree without a whit of difference to the tree. They were everywhere. Them trees was big enough you could have made 2 floors and carved a staircase up and slept inside the middle of a tree. If you had a mind to work like that, it wouldn't hurt the tree. Them trees are gone. But trees don't die for just 200 years. Old trees move slow. Each spring is one more morning and goes 1,000 years before a tree begins to look at getting old. Them trees are gone. These here, these little ones, they're good to climb because you can get your arms and legs around and shinny up the children of old trees. But this place is not a forest. It's bramble brakes and laurel hells. It's good to have for hunting in. It used to be the lower limbs and branches of the trees stood above the ground at 8 or 10 men's height, and in the forest was the only place where you could see along the ground.
The Nurse Log by Al Purdy. These are my children. These are my grandchildren. They have green hair. Their bones grow from my bones. When rain comes, they drink the sky. I am their mother and grandmother. I am their past. Their memory is my 1,000 years of growing and waiting for them. 400 rings passed in my body count. There was fire. It touched me and I glowed with blue fire from the sky. The sky was so close it hissed and shimmered in me. Then rain fell. 350 rings passed. There was no rain for many growing times. But when it came, I heard the forest talking together. How great a time ago is lost, but I remember long-necked animals eating me. One great-jawed creature eating them. Everything consumed everything else, and wondered if living was eating. Then the birds came, but strange birds like reptiles with broad leathery wings, flapping and crashing through me. They changed to specks of blue and orange and green and yellow, little suns sleeping in me. I remember this in a dream, when we all dreamed as if I were an old repeated story, once told to me that I retell. And now the little green ones nesting cleverly in a row, some love the shade and some the sun. Another is growing crookedly, but she will straighten given time. One grows more slowly than the others and has my own special affection. They are so different, these small ones. Their green hair shines. They lift their bodies high and light. They droop in rain and move in unison toward some lost, remembered place we came from like a question. Like a question and the answer nobody remembers now. No one can remember. Chainsaw at dawn in Vermont in time of drought. By Robert Penn Warren. Dawn and distant, the steel snarl and lyric of the chainsaw in deep woods. I wake. Was it trunk scream, bough rip and swish, then earth thud? No, only the saw's song. The saw sings, now, sings, now, now, now. In the lash and bloodlust of an eternal present, the present murders the past, the nerve shrieks. The saw sings, now, and I wake, rising from that darkness of sleep, which is the past and is the self. It is myself, and I know how. Now, far off. New light gilds the spruce tops. The saw for a moment ceases, and under armpits of the blue-shirted sawyer, sweat beads cold. And in the obscene silence of the saw's cessation, a crow somewhere calls. The crow in distance calls with the crystalline beauty of the outraged heart. Have I learned how to live?
It Rained by P. Lazard. It rained, and the hibiscus hedge like a fresh torn graze is red with blossom, burst blood from the leather-green sheen of the leaves. It rained, and the grass, sparse as an old man's hair, broke the ground black with life. Rain and cold water feathers itself in bubbling puddles, and at night bursts with sound. Rain, and the world is drowned in a dazzle of falling light.